Yeah, Cantor nodded. The boss had me run through it over the weekend. What do you think? I think this O'Donnell character is one formidable son of a bitch. He's got his outfit organized and trained like a real army. It's small enough that he knows every one of them. His ideological background tells me he's a careful recruiter. He has an unusually high degree of trust in his troops. He's a political animal, but he knows how to think and plan like a soldier. Who trained him? Nobody knows, Cantor replied. I think you can overestimate that factor, though. I know that, Ryan agreed. What I'm looking for is flavor, I guess. I'm trying to get a feel for how he thinks. It would also be nice to know who's bankrolling him. Ryan paused, and something else leaped into his mind. What are the chances that he has people inside the PIRA? What do you mean? He runs for his life when he finds out that the PIRA leadership is out for his ass. 2 years later, he's back in business with his own organization. Where did the troops come from? Some pals from inside the PIRA, obviously, Cantor said. Sure, Jack nodded. People he knew to be reliable. But we also know that he's a counterintelligence type, right? What do you mean? Cantor hadn't been down this road yet. Who's the main threat to O'Donnell? Everybody wants him. Who wants to kill him? Jack refocused the question. The Brits don't have capital punishment, but the PIRA does. So? So if you were O'Donnell, and you recruited people from inside the PIRA, and you knew that the PIRA was interested in having your head on a wall plaque, you think you'd leave people inside to cue you in? Makes sense, Cantor said thoughtfully. Next, who is the ULA's political target? We don't know that. Don't give me that crap, Marty, Ryan snapped. Most of the information in these documents comes from inside the provost, doesn't it? How the hell do these people know what the ULA is up to? How does the data get to them? You're pushing, Jack, Cantor warned. I've seen the data, too. It's mainly negative. The provos who had the information sweated out of them mainly said that certain operations weren't theirs. The conclusion that ULA did them is inferential, circumstantial. I don't think that this stuff is as clear as you do. No. The two guys who did this report make a good case for putting the ULA fingerprint on these ops. What the ULA has is its own style, Marty. We can identify that, can't we? You've constructed a circular argument, Cantor pointed out. O'Donnell comes from the provos, therefore he must have recruited from there, therefore he must have people in there, etc. Your basic arguments are logical, but try to remember that they're based on a very shaky foundation. What if the ULA really is a special action group of the provisionals? Isn't it in their interest to have something like that? Cantor was a splendid devil's advocate, one of the reasons he was Greer's executive assistant. Okay. There is some truth to that, Ryan admitted. Still, everything I say makes sense. Assuming that the ULA is real. Granted that it's logical, but not proven. So it's the first logical thing we have for these characters. What else does that tell us? Cantor grinned. Let me know when you figure it out. Can I talk to anybody about this? Like who? I just want to ask before I say no. The legal attaché in London. Dan Murray, Ryan said. He's supposed to be cleared all the way on this material, isn't he? Yeah, he is. And he works with our people, too. Okay, you can talk with him. That keeps it in the family. Thanks. 5 minutes later, Cantor was sitting across from Admiral Greer's desk. He really knows how to ask the right questions. So what did he tumble to? The Admiral asked. The same questions that Emil Jacobs and his team have been asking. What's O'Donnell up to? Does he have the PIRA infiltrated? If so, why? And Jack says? Same as Jacobs and the FBI evaluation. O'Donnell is a counterintelligence type by training. The provos want his hide on the barn door, and the best way to keep his hide where it belongs is to have people inside to warn him if they get too close. The admiral nodded agreement, then looked away for a moment. That was only part of an answer, his instincts told him. There had to be more. Anything else?
The training stuff. He hasn't sifted through all the data yet. I think we should give him some time.
But you were right, sir.
He's pretty sharp.
Murray lifted his phone and pushed the right button without paying much attention.
Yeah.
Dan? This is Jack Ryan, the voice on the phone said.
How's it going, teacher?
Not bad. Something I want to talk over with you.
Shoot.
I think the ULA has the PIRA infiltrated.
What?
Murray snapped upright in his chair.
Hey, Ace, I can't...
He looked at the telephone. The line he was talking on was...
What the hell are you doing on a secure line?
Let's say that I'm back in government service, Ryan replied coyly.
Nobody told me.
So what do you think?
I think it's a possibility. Jimmy came up with the idea about 3 months back. The Bureau agrees that it makes sense. There is no objective evidence to support the theory, but everybody thinks it's logical. I mean, it would be a smart thing for our friend Kevin to do, if he can. Remember that the PIRA has very good internal security, Jack.
You told me that most of what we know about the ULA comes from PIRA sources. How do they get the info? Ryan asked rapidly.
What? You lost me.
How does the PIRA find out what the ULA is doing?
Oh, okay. That we don't know.
It was something that bothered Murray and James Owens, but cops deal all the time with anonymous information sources.
Why would they be doing that?
Telling the provos what they're up to?
We have no idea. If you have a suggestion, I'm open to it.
How about recruiting new members for his team? Ryan asked.
Why don't you think that one over for a few seconds? Murray replied immediately.
Ryan had just rediscovered the flat earth theory. There was a moment of silence.
Oh.
Then he'd risk being infiltrated by the provisionals.
Very good, Ace. If O'Donnell's got them infiltrated as a security measure to protect himself, why invite members of the group that wants his ass into his own fold? If you want to kill yourself, there are simpler ways, Jack.
Murray had to laugh. He could hear Ryan deflate over the phone.
Okay. I guess I had that coming. Thanks. Sorry to rain on your parade, but we buried that idea a couple of months ago.
But he must have recruited his people from the provisionals to begin with, Ryan objected belatedly.
He cursed himself for being so slow, but remembered that Murray had been an expert on this subject for years.
Yeah, I'll buy that. But he kept the numbers very low, Murray said.
The bigger the organization gets, the greater the risk that the provos will infiltrate and destroy him.
Hey, they really want his ass on a platter, Jack.
Murray stopped short of revealing the deal David Ashley had cut with the PIRA. CIA didn't know about that yet.
How's the family? He asked, changing the subject.
Fine. Bill Shaw says he talked to you last week, Murray said.
Yeah. That's why I'm here now. You've got me looking over my shoulder, Dan. Anything else that you've cued in on?
It was Murray's turn to deflate.
The more I think about it, the more it looks like I got worried over nothing. No evidence at all, Jack. It was just instinct, you know. Like from an old woman.
Sorry.
I think I just overreacted to something Jimmy said. Hope I didn't worry you too much.
Don't sweat it, Jack replied. Well, I have to clear out of here. See ya.
Yeah.
Bye, Jack. Murray replaced the phone in the holder and went back to his paperwork. Ryan did much the same. He had to leave by noon in order to make his first class of the day.
The messenger came back with his cart and took the files away, along with Jack's notes, which, of course, were also classified. He left the building a few minutes later, his mind still sifting through the data he'd read. What Jack didn't know was that in the new annex to the CIA headquarters building was the headquarters of the National Reconnaissance Office. This was a joint CIA-Air Force agency that managed the data from satellites and, to a lesser degree, high-altitude reconnaissance aircraft. The new generation of satellites used television-type scanning cameras instead of photographic film. One consequence of this was that they could be used almost continuously instead of husbanding their film for coverage of the Soviet Union and its satellites. This allowed the NRO to assemble a much better database on world trends and events, and it generated scores of new projects for hundreds of new analysts, explaining the newly built annex behind the original CIA building. One junior analyst's brief was coverage on camps suspected to be used for the training of terrorists. The project had not yet shown enough results to be treated more importantly, though the data and photographs were passed on to the Task Force on Combating Terrorism. TFCT used the satellite photos, as was the norm in government circles. The staffers oohed and aahed over the clarity of the shots, were briefed on the new charge-coupled devices that enabled the cameras to get high-resolution pictures despite atmospheric disturbances, noted that, despite all the hoopla, you really couldn't read the numbers on a license plate, and promptly forgot about them as anything more than pictures of camps where terrorists might be training. Photo reconnaissance interpretation had always been a narrow field for experts only. The analysis work was simply too technical. And as was so often the case, here was the rub. The junior analyst was better described as a technician. He collected and collated data, but didn't really analyze it. That was someone else's job for when the project was finished. In this particular case, the data being processed noted infrared energy. The camps he examined on a daily basis, there were over 200, were mainly in deserts. That was remarkably good luck. While everyone knew that deserts suffer from blistering daylight heat, it was less appreciated that they can get quite cold at night, falling below freezing in many cases. So the technician was trying to determine the occupancy of the camps from the number of buildings that were heated during the cool nights. These showed up quite well on the infrared, bright blobs of white on a cold black background. A computer stored the digital signals from the satellite. The technician called up the camps by code number, noted the number of heated buildings in each, and transferred the data to a second data file. Camp 11518. Located at 28 degrees, 32 minutes, 47 seconds north latitude, 19 degrees, 07 minutes, 52 seconds east longitude, had six buildings, one of which was a garage. This one had at least two vehicles in it. Though the building was unheated, the thermal signatures of two internal combustion engines radiated clearly through the corrugated steel roofs. Of the other five buildings, only one had its heater on, the technician noted. The previous week, he checked. Three had been warm. The warm one now, the data sheet said, was occupied by a small guard and maintenance group, thought to be five men. It evidently had its own kitchen, since one part of the building was always a little warmer than the rest. Another building was a full-size dining hall. That and the dormitories were now empty. The technician made the appropriate notations, and the computer assigned them to a simple line graph that peaked when occupancy was high and fell when it was low. The technician didn't have the time to check the patterns on the graph, but he assumed, wrongly, that someone else did.
"You remember, Lieutenant," Breckinridge said. "Deep breath, let it half out, and squeeze gently."
The 9mm Browning automatic had excellent sights. Ryan centered them on the circular target and did what the gunny said. He did it right. The flash and sound of the shot came almost as a surprise to him. The automatic ejected the spent round and was ready to fire again as Jack brought the pistol down from recoil. He repeated the procedure four more times. The pistol locked open on the empty clip, and Ryan set it down. Next, he took off the muff-type ear protectors. His ears were sweaty. 2 9s, 3 10s, two of them in the X-ray.
Breckenridge stood away from the spotting scope.
Not as good as the last time.
My arm's tired, Ryan explained. The pistol weighed almost 40 ounces. It didn't seem like much weight until you had to hold it stone steady at arm's length for an hour.
You can get some wrist weights, you know, like joggers use. It'll build up your forearm and wrist muscles.
Breckenridge slipped 5 rounds into the clip of Ryan's pistol and stepped to the line to aim at a fresh target. The sergeant major fired all 5 in under 3 seconds. Ryan looked in the spotting scope. There were 5 holes within the target's X-ring, clustered like the petals on a flower.
Damn, I forgot how much fun a nice Browning could be.
He ejected the clip and reloaded.
The sights are right on, too.
I noticed, Jack replied lamely.
Don't feel too bad, Lieutenant, Breckenridge said. I've been doing this since you were in diapers.
5 more rounds and the center was effectively removed from the target, 50 feet away.
Why are we doing round targets anyway? Jack asked. I want you to get used to the idea of placing your shots exactly where you want them to go, the gunny explained. We'll sweat the fancy stuff later. For now, we'll work on basic skills.
You look a little looser today, Lieutenant.
Yeah, well, I talked to the FBI guy who originated the warning. Now, he says, he might have overreacted.
Maybe I did, too. Breckenridge shrugged.
You never been in combat, Lieutenant.
I have.
One thing you learn. The first twitch you have is usually right. Keep that in mind.
Jack nodded, not believing it. He'd accomplished much today. His look at the ULA data told him a lot about the organization, but there was not the first inkling that they had ever operated at all in America. The provisional IRA had plenty of American connections, but no one believed that the ULA did. Even if they planned to do something here, Ryan judged, they'd need the connections. It was possible that O'Donnell might call on some of his previous PIRA friends, but that seemed most unlikely. He was a dangerous man, but only on his own turf. And America wasn't his turf. That's what the data said. Jack knew that this was too broad a conclusion to base on one day's work, of course. He'd keep looking. It seemed that his investigation would last 2 or 3 weeks the way he was going. If nothing else, he wanted to look into the relationship between O'Donnell and the provost. He did have a feeling that something odd was going on, just as Murray evidently did, and he wanted to examine the data fully, in the hope of coming up with a plausible theory. He owed CIA something for its courtesy. The storm was magnificent. Miller and O'Donnell stood by the leaded glass windows and watched as the Atlantic gale beat the sea to foaming waves that slammed against the base of the cliff on which the house stood. The crash of the breaking waves provided the bass notes, while the wind howled and whistled through the trees and raindrops beat their tattoo against the house itself.
Not a day to be sailing, Sean, O'Donnell said as he sipped at a whiskey.
When do our colleagues go to America?
3 weeks.
Not much time.
Do you still want to do it?
The chief of the ULA thought the timing marginal for what Sean planned.
This is not an opportunity to be missed, Kevin, Miller answered evenly.
Do you have another motive? O'Donnell asked.
Better to get it in the open, he decided.
Consider the ramifications.
The provisionals go over to proclaim their innocence, and—
Yes, I know.
It is a fine opportunity.
Very well.
When do you want to leave?
Wednesday morning.
We must move quickly.
Even with our contacts. It won't be easy.
Chapter 13 Visitors. The two men hunched over the blow-up of the map, flanked by several 8x10 photographs.
This is going to be the hard one, Alex said. This one, I can't help you with.
What's the problem?
Sean could see it, but by asking the question he could also gauge the skill of his new associate.
He'd never worked with a black before, and though he'd met Alex and members of his group the year before, both were unknown quantities, at least in an operational sense. He always comes out by Gate 3, here. This street, as you see, is a dead end. He has to go straight west or turn north coming out. He has done both. This street here is wide enough to do the job from a car, but this one, too narrow, and it leads the wrong way. That means the only sure spot is right here at the corner. Traffic lights, here and here. Alex pointed. Both these streets are narrow and always have cars parked on both sides. This building is apartments. These are houses, expensive ones. There isn't much pedestrian traffic here, oddly enough. One man can probably get by. Two or more, He shook his head. And it's a white area. A black man would be conspicuous. Your guy has to wing this one alone, pal, and he's gotta be on foot. Probably inside this door is the best place, but he'll have to be on his toes, or the target will get away. How does he get out? Sean asked. I can park a car around this corner, or this one. Timing for that is not a concern. We can wait all day for the right slot. We have a choice of escape routes. That's no problem either. At rush hour, the streets are crowded. That actually works for us. The cops will have trouble responding, and we can use a car that looks ordinary, like a state-owned one. They can't stop all of them. Getaway is easy. The problem is your man. He has to be right here. Why not catch him in his car at a different place? Alex shook his head. Too hard. The roads are too crowded, to be sure, and it'd be too easy to lose him. You've seen the traffic, Sean, and he never goes exactly the same way twice. If you want my opinion, you should split the operation. Do it one part at a time. No. Miller was adamant. We'll do it the way I want. Okay, man. But I'm telling you, this man is exposed. Miller thought that one over for a moment. Finally, he smiled. I have just the right man for it. The other part. Alex switched maps. Easy. The target can take any route at all, but they all come to this place here at exactly 4:45. We've checked 6 days in the past 2 weeks, never been off by more than 5 minutes. We'll do the job right along here, close to the bridge. Anybody could handle this one. We can even rehearse it for you. When? This afternoon, good enough. Alex smiled. Indeed. Escape route. We'll show you. We might as well make it a real rehearsal. Excellent. Miller was well pleased. Getting here had been complicated enough. Not difficult, just complicated, involving 6 separate flights. It hadn't been without humor, though. Sean Miller was traveling on a British passport at the moment, and the immigration clerk at Miami had taken his Belfast accent for Scottish. It hadn't occurred to him that to an American ear there isn't much difference between a brogue and a burr. If that's the skill level in American law enforcement officials, Miller told himself, this op should go easily enough. They'd do the run-through today. If it looked good, he'd summon the team, and they'd go in 4 days, he judged. The weapons were already in place. Conclusions? Cantor asked. Ryan picked up a 60-page sheaf of paper. Here's my analysis, for what it's worth. Not much, Jack admitted. I didn't turn up anything new. The reports you already have are pretty good, given the lack of real evidence to go on. The ULA is a really kinky bunch. On one hand, their operations don't seem to have a real purpose that we can discern. But this kind of skill... They're too professional to be operating without an objective, dammit. True enough, Cantor said. They were in his office across the hall from the DDIs. Admiral Greer was out of town. You come up with anything at all? I've mapped their operations geographically and against time.
No pattern there that I can see. The only visible pattern is in the type of operation and the execution. But that doesn't mean anything. They like high-profile targets, but hell, what terrorist doesn't? That's the whole point of being a terrorist, going after the really big game, right? They mostly use East Bloc weapons, but most of the groups do. We infer that they're well-financed. That's logical, given the nature of their activity. But again, there isn't any substantive evidence to confirm it. O'Donnell has a real talent for dropping out of sight, both personally and professionally. There are 3 whole years we can't account for, one before he turned up around the time of Bloody Sunday, and 2 years after the provost tried to punch his ticket. They're both complete blanks. I talked to my wife about the plastic surgery angle. What? Cantor didn't react favorably to that. She doesn't know why I wanted the information. Give me a break, Marty. I'm married to a surgeon, remember? One of her classmates is a reconstructive surgeon, and I had Kathy ask him where you can get a new face. Not many places that can really do it. I was surprised. I have a list of where they are in here. 2 are behind the curtain. It turns out that some of the real pioneering work was done in Moscow before World War II. Hopkins people have been to the Institute. It's named for the guy, but I can't recall the name. And they found a few odd things about the place. Like what? Cantor asked. Like 2 floors that you can't get onto. Annette DeSalvi, Kathy's classmate, was there 2 years ago. The top 2 floors of the place can be reached only by special elevators, and the stairways have barred gates. Odd sort of thing for a hospital. He thought that was a funny bit of information. Maybe it'll be useful to somebody else. Cantor nodded. He knew something about this particular clinic, but the closed doors were something new. It was amazing, he thought, how new bits of data could turn up so innocently. He also wondered why a surgical team from Johns Hopkins had been allowed into the place. He made a mental note to check that out. Kathy says this getting a new face thing isn't what it's cracked up to be. Most of the work is designed to correct damage from trauma, car accidents and things like that. The job isn't so much to change as to repair. There is a lot of cosmetic work, I mean aside from nose jobs and facelifts, but that you can accomplish almost as well with a new hairstyle and a beard. They can change chins and cheekbones pretty well, but if the work is too extensive, it leaves scars. This place in Moscow is good, Annette says, almost as good as Hopkins or even UCLA. A lot of the best reconstructive surgeons are in California, Jack explained. Anyway, we're not talking a facelift or a nose job here. Extensive facial surgery involves multiple procedures and takes several months. If O'Donnell was gone for 2 years, a lot of the time was spent in the body shop. Oh, Cantor got the point. He really is a fast worker, then. Jack grinned. That's what I was really after. He was out of sight for 2 years. At least 6 months of that time must have been spent in some hospital or other. So in the other 18 months, he recruited his people, set up a base of operations, started collecting operational intelligence, and ran his first op. Not bad, Cantor said thoughtfully. Yeah. So he had to have recruited people from in the provos. They must have brought some stuff with them, too. I'll bet that his initial operations were things the PIRA had already looked at and set aside for one reason or another. That's why the Brits thought they were actually part of the PIRA to begin with, Marty. You said you didn't find anything important, Cantor said. This sounds like pretty sharp analysis to me. Maybe. All I did was reorder stuff you already had. Nothing new is in here, and I still haven't answered my own question. I don't have much of an idea what they're really up to. Ryan's hand flipped through the pages of manuscript. His voice showed his frustration. Jack was not accustomed to failure. We still don't know where these bastards are coming from. They're up to something, but damned if I know what it is. American connections? None. None at all that we know of. That makes me feel a lot better. There's no hint of a contact with American organizations, and lots of reasons for them not to have any. O'Donnell is too slick to play with his old PIRA contacts.
But his recruiting, Cantor objected. Jack cut him off. Over here, I mean. As chief of internal security, he could know who was who in Belfast and Londonderry. But the American connections to the provisionals all run through Sinn Féin, the provost's political wing. He'd have to be crazy to trust them. Remember, he did his best to restructure the political leanings in the outfit and failed.
Okay, I see what you mean. Possible connections with other groups?
Ryan shook his head. No evidence.
I wouldn't bet against contact with some of the European groups, maybe some of the Islamic ones even, but not over here. O'Donnell's a smart cookie. To come over here means too many complications. Hey, they don't like me, I can dig that.
The good news is that the FBI's right. We're dealing with professionals. I am not a politically significant target. Coming after me has no political value. And these are political animals, Jack observed confidently. Thank God.
Did you know that the PIRA, well, Sinn Féin, has a delegation coming over day after tomorrow?
What for?
The thing in London hurt them in Boston and New York. They've denied involvement about 100 times, and they have a bunch coming over for a couple of weeks to tell the local Irish communities in person.
Ah, crap, Ryan snarled. Why not keep the bastards out of the friggin' country?
Not that easy. The people coming over aren't on the watch list. They've been here before. They're clean, technically. We live in a free democracy, Jack. Remember what Oliver Wendell Holmes said? The Constitution was written for people of fundamentally differing views. Or something like that. The short name is freedom of speech.
Ryan had to smile. The outside view of the Central Intelligence Agency people was often one of bumbling fascists, threats to American freedom, corrupt but incompetent schemers, a cross between the Mafia and the Marx Brothers. In fact, Ryan had found them to be politically moderate, more so than he was. If the truth ever got out, of course, the press would think it was a sinister ruse. Even he found it very odd.
I hope somebody will keep an eye on them, Jack observed.
The FBI will have people in every bar, swilling their John Jameson and singing the men behind the wire, and keeping an eye on everything. The Bureau's pretty good at that. They've just about ended the gun running. The word's gotten out on that. Must be a half dozen people who got sent up the river for sending guns and explosives over.
Fine. So now the bad guys use Kalashnikovs, or Armalites made in Singapore.
That, Cantor said, is not our responsibility.
Well, this here's all that I was able to come up with, Marty. Unless there's other data around, that's all I can give you.
Jack tossed the report in Cantor's lap.
I'll read this over and get back to you.
Back to teaching history?
Yep.
Ryan stood and got his coat from the back of the chair. He paused.
What if something about these guys turns up in a different place?
This is the only compartment you can see, Jack.
I know that. What I'm asking is, the way this place is set up, how do you connect things from different compartments?
That's why we have supervisory oversight teams. And computers, Cantor answered.
Not that the system always works.
If anything new turns up...
It's flagged, Cantor said. Both here and at the FBI. If we get any sort of twitch on these fellows, you'll be warned the day we get it.
Fair enough. Ryan made sure his pass was hanging in plain view before going out into the corridor.
Thanks. And please thank the Admiral for me. You guys didn't have to do this. I wouldn't feel this good if somebody else had told me what I saw for myself. I owe you.
You'll be hearing from us, Cantor promised him.
Ryan nodded and went out the door. He'd be hearing from them, all right. They'd make the offer again, and he'd turn it down again. with the greatest reluctance, of course. He'd gone out of his way to be humble and polite with Cantor. In truth, he thought his 60-page report did a pretty good job of organizing what data they did have on the ULA. That squared matters. He didn't really think he owed anybody. Caroline Muller Ryan, M.D., FACS, lived a very controlled and structured life. She liked it that way. In surgery, she always worked with the same team of doctors, nurses, and technicians. They knew how she liked to work, how she liked her instruments arranged. Most surgeons had their peculiarities, and the ophthalmic specialists were unusually fastidious. Her team tolerated it because she was one of the best technical surgeons of her age group, and also one of the easiest to like. She rarely had problems with her temper, and got along well with her nurses, something that female doctors often had trouble with. Her current problem was her pregnancy, which forced her to limit her exposure to certain operating room chemicals. Her swelling abdomen was beginning to alter her stance at the table. Actually, eye surgeons usually sit, but the principle was the same. Kathy Ryan had to reach a little farther now, and joked about it constantly. These traits carried over to her personal life also. She drove her Porsche with mechanistic precision, always shifting the gears at exactly the right RPM setting, taking corners on a line as regular as a Formula One driver's. Doing things the same way every time wasn't a rut for Kathy Ryan. It was perfection. She played the piano that way also. Sissy Jackson, who played and taught professionally, had once remarked that her playing was too perfect, lacking in soul. Kathy took that as a compliment. Surgeons don't autograph their work. They do it the right way, every time. Which was why she was annoyed with life at the moment. It was a minor annoyance having to take a slightly different route to work every day. In fact, it was something of a challenge, since she gave herself the goal of not allowing it to affect her schedule. Driving to and from work never took more than 57 minutes, nor less than 49, unless she came in on a weekend, when different traffic rules applied. She always picked up Sally at exactly 4:45. Taking new routes, mainly inside Baltimore, threatened to change this segment of her life. But there weren't many driving problems that a Porsche 911 couldn't solve. Her route this day was down State Route 3, then across a secondary road. That brought her out onto Ritchie Highway, 6 miles above the Giant Steps Nursery School. She caught the light just right and took the turn in second gear, working quickly up to third, then fourth. The feline growl of the six-cylinder engine reached through the sound insulation as a gentle purr. Kathy Ryan loved her Porsche. She'd never driven anything else until after she was married. A station wagon was useful for shopping and family drives, unfortunately, and wondered what she'd do when her second child arrived. That, she sighed, would be a problem. It depended on where the sitter was, she decided. Or maybe she could finally convince Jack to get a nanny. Her husband was a little too working class in that respect. He'd resisted the idea of hiring a part-time maid to help with the housework. That was all the more crazy since Kathy knew her husband tended to be something of a slob, slow to hang up his clothing. Getting the maid had changed that a little. Now, nights before the maid was due in, Jack scurried around picking things up so that she wouldn't think the Ryans were a family of slovens. Jack could be so funny. Yes, she thought, we'll get a nanny. After all, Jack's a knight now. Kathy smiled at the traffic. Pushing him in the right direction wouldn't be all that hard. Jack was very easy to manipulate. She changed lanes and darted past a dump truck in third gear. The Porsche made it so easy to accelerate around things. She turned right into the Giant Steps parking lot 2 minutes later. The sports car bumped over the uneven driveway and she brought it to a stop in the usual spot. Kathy locked the car on getting out, of course. Her Porsche was 6 years old, but meticulously maintained. It had been her present to herself on getting through her intern year at Hopkins. There wasn't a single scratch on the British Racing green finish, and only a Hopkins parking sticker marred the gleaming chrome bumper. "Mommy!" Sally met her at the door. Kathy bent to pick her up. It was getting harder to bend over, and harder still to stand up with Sally around her neck. She hoped that their daughter would not feel threatened by the arrival of the baby. Some kids were, she knew, but she had already explained to the little girl what was going on, and Sally seemed to like the idea of a new brother or sister. "So what did my big girl do today?" Dr. Ryan asked. Sally liked being called a big girl, and this was Kathy's subterfuge for ensuring that sibling rivalry would be minimized by the arrival of a little boy or girl. Sally wriggled free to drop back to the floor and held up a finger painting done on what looked like wide carriage computer paper. It was a credible abstract work of purple and orange. Together, mother and daughter went to the back and got her coat and lunchbox. Kathy made sure that Sally's coat was zipped and the hood up. It was only a few degrees above freezing outside, and they didn't want Sally to get another cold. It took a total of 5 minutes from the time Kathy stopped the car until she was back out the door, walking toward it again. She didn't really notice the routineness of her daily schedule. Kathy unlocked the door, got Sally into her seat, and made sure the seatbelt was fastened snugly before closing and locking the door and going around to the left side of the car. She looked up briefly. Across Ritchie Highway was a small shopping center, a 7-Eleven store, a cleaner's, a video store, and a hardware dealer. There was a blue van parked at the 7-Eleven again. She'd noticed it twice the previous week. Kathy shrugged it off. 7-Eleven was a convenience store, and lots of people made it a regular stop on the way home.
"Hello, Lady Ryan," Miller said inside the van.
The two windows in the rear doors, they reminded Miller of the police transport van. He smiled to himself at that, were made of coated glass so that an outsider couldn't see in. Alex was in the store getting a six-pack of Cokes, as he'd done on a fairly regular basis the previous 2 weeks. Miller checked his watch. She'd arrived at 4:46 and was leaving at 4:52. Next to him, a man with a camera was shooting away. Miller raised binoculars. The green Porsche would be easy to spot. Plus, it had a customized license plate. CRSRGN. Alex had explained how license plates in Maryland could be bought to individual specifications, and Sean wondered who'd be using that code next year. Surely there was another surgeon with the initials CR. Alex got back in and started the engine. The van left the parking lot just as the target's Porsche did. Alex did his own driving. He went north on Ritchie Highway, hung a quick U-turn, and raced south to keep the Porsche in sight. Miller joined him in the right side seat.
"She takes this road south to Route 50, across the Severn River Bridge, then gets off 50 onto Route 2. We want to hit her before she does that. We'll proceed, take the same exit, and switch cars where I showed you."
"Too bad," Alex said. "I was beginning to like this here van."
"You can buy another with what we're paying you."
A grin split the black face.
"Yeah, I expect so. Have a better interior on the next one, too."
He turned right, taking the exit onto Route 50. It was a divided multi-lane highway. Traffic was moderate to heavy. Alex explained that this was normal.
"No problem getting the job done," he assured Miller.
"Excellent," Miller agreed. "Good work, Alex.
Even if you do have a big mouth."
Kathy always drove more sedately with Sally aboard. The little girl craned her neck to see over the dashboard, her left hand fiddling with the seatbelt buckle as it usually did. Her mother was relaxing now. It generally took her about this length of time to settle down from a hard day. There were few easy ones at the Wilmer Eye Institute. It wasn't stress so much. She'd had 2 procedures today and would have 2 more the next day. She loved her work. There were a lot of people now who could see only because of her professional skill, and the satisfaction of that was not something easily communicated, even to Jack. The price of it was that her days were rarely easy ones. The minute precision demanded by ophthalmic surgery denied her coffee. She couldn't risk the slight tremor in her hands that might come from caffeine, and imposed a degree of concentration on her that few professions demanded. There were more difficult medical skills, but not many. This was the main reason she drove her 911. It was as though, in pushing through the air, or taking a tight corner at 25 in second gear, the car drained the excess energy from the driver and spread it into the environment. She almost always got home in a good mood. Tonight would be better still, since it was Jack's turn to fix dinner. If the car had been built with a brain, it would have noticed the reduced pressure on accelerator and brakes as they took the Route 2 exit. It was being pampered now, like a faithful horse that had jumped all the fences properly. "Okay?" Alex asked, keeping west on Route 50 toward Washington. The other man in the back handed Miller the clipboard with the new time notation. There was a total of 7 entries, all but the last complete with photographs. Sean looked at the numbers. The target was on a beautifully regular schedule.
"Fine," he said after a moment.
"I can't give you a precise spot for the hit. Traffic can make things go a little funny. I'd say we should try on the east side of the bridge."
"Agreed."
Kathy Ryan walked into her house 15 minutes later. She unzipped Sally's coat and watched her little, big girl struggle out of the sleeves, a skill she was just beginning to acquire. Kathy took it and hung it up before getting out of her coat. Mother and daughter then proceeded to the kitchen, where they heard the unmistakable noise of a husband trying to fix dinner and a television tuned to the McNeil-Lara report.
"Daddy, look what I did," Sally said first.
"Oh, great."
Jack took the picture and examined it with great care.
"I think we'll hang this one up."
All of them got hung up. The art gallery in question was the front of the family refrigerator. A magnetized holder gave the finger painting a semi-permanent place over the ice and cold water dispenser. Sally never noticed that there was a new hanging spot every day, nor did she know that every such painting was saved, tucked away in a box in a foyer closet. "Hi, babe." Jack kissed his wife next. "How are things today?"
"2 cornea replacements."
Bernie assisted on the second one. "It was a bear.
Tomorrow I'm scheduled for a vitrectomy. Bernie says hi, by the way."
"How's his kid?" Jack asked.
"Just an appendectomy.
She'll be climbing the monkey bars next week," Kathy replied, surveying the kitchen. She often wondered if having Jack fix dinner was worth the wreckage he made of her room. It appeared that he was fixing pot roast, but she wasn't sure. It wasn't that Jack was a bad cook. With some things, he was pretty good. He was just so damn sloppy about it. Never kept his utensils neat. Kathy always had her knives, forks, and everything else arranged like a surgical instrument tray. Jack would just set them anywhere and spent half of his time looking for where they were. Sally left the room and found a TV that didn't have a news show on.
"Good news," Jack said.
"Oh?"
"I finished up at CIA today."
"So what are you smiling about?"
"There just isn't anything I see to make me suspect that we have anything to worry about."
Jack explained for several minutes, keeping within the bounds of classification.
"Mostly.
They've never operated over here. They don't have any contacts over here that we know of. The real thing is that we're not good targets for them."
"Why?"
"We're not political. The people they go after are soldiers, police, judges, mayors, stuff like that."
"Not to mention the yacht prince," Kathy observed.
"Yeah, well, we're not one of those either, are we?"
"So what are you telling me?"
"They're a scary bunch. That Miller kid. Well, we've talked about that. I'll feel a little better when they have him back in the can. But these guys are pros. They're not going to mount an op 3,000 miles from home for revenge."
Kathy took his hand.
"You're sure?"
"Sure as I can be. The intelligence biz isn't like mathematics, but you get a feel for the other guy,
the way his head works. A terrorist kills to make a political point. We ain't political fodder.
Kathy gave her husband a gentle smile.
So I can relax now?
I think so. Still, keep an eye on the mirror.
And you're not going to carry that gun anymore, she said hopefully.
Babe, I like shooting. I forgot what fun a pistol can be. I'm going to keep shooting at the academy, but no, I won't be wearing it anymore.
And the shotgun?
It hasn't hurt anybody.
I don't like it, Jack. At least unload it, okay?
She walked off to the bedroom to change.
Okay.
It wasn't that important. He'd keep the box of shells right next to the gun, on the top shelf of the closet. Sally couldn't reach it. Even Kathy had to stretch. It would be safe there. Jack reconsidered all his actions over the past 3.5 weeks and decided that they had been worthwhile, really. The alarm system on the house wasn't such a bad idea, and he liked his new 9mm Browning. He was getting pretty good scores. If he kept at it for a year, maybe he could give Breckenridge a run for his money. He checked the oven. Another 10 minutes. Next, he turned up the TV. The current segment on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour was,
I'll be damned.
Joining us from our affiliate WGBH in Boston is Padraig, did I pronounce that right? O'Neill, a spokesman for Sinn Féin and an elected member of the British Parliament. Mr. O'Neill, why are you visiting America at this time?
I and many of my colleagues have visited America many times, to inform the American people of the oppression inflicted upon the Irish people by the British government, the systematic denial of economic opportunity and basic civil rights, the total abrogation of the judicial process, and the continuing brutality of the British Army of Occupation against the people of Ireland, O'Neill said in a smooth and reasonable voice. He had done all this before.
Mr. O'Neill, said someone from the British Embassy in Washington, is the political frontman for the provisional wing of the so-called Irish Republican Army. This is a terrorist organization that is illegal both in Northern Ireland and in the Irish Republic. His mission in the United States is, as always, to raise money so that his organization can buy arms and explosives. This source of income for the IRA was damaged by the cowardly attack against the royal family in London last year, and his reason for being here is to persuade Irish Americans that the IRA had no part in that.
Mr. O'Neill, McNeil said, how do you respond to that? The Irishman smiled at the camera as benignly as Bob Keeshan's Captain Kangaroo.
Mr. Bennett, as usual, skirts over the legitimate political issues here. Are Northern Ireland's Catholics denied economic and political opportunity? Yes, they are. Have the legal processes in Northern Ireland been subverted for political reasons by the British government? Yes, they have. Are we any closer to a political settlement of this dispute that goes back in its modern phase to 1969?
No, I regret to say we are not.
If I am a terrorist, why have I been allowed into your country? I am, in fact, a member of the British Parliament, elected by the people of my parliamentary district.
But you don't take your seat in Parliament, McNeil objected.
And join the government that is killing my constituents.
Jesus, Ryan said. What a mess.
He turned the TV off.
Such a reasonable man, Miller said.
Alex's house was outside the DC Beltway.
Tell your friends how reasonable you are, Paddy. And when you get to the pubs tonight, be sure to tell your friends that you have never hurt anyone who was not a genuine oppressor of the Irish people.
Sean watched the whole segment, then placed an overseas call to a payphone outside a Dublin pub. The next morning, only 5 hours later in Ireland, 4 men boarded a plane for Paris. Neatly dressed, they looked like young executives traveling with their soft luggage to business appointments overseas. At Charles de Gaulle International Airport, they made connections to a flight to Caracas. From there, they flew Eastern Airlines to Atlanta, and another Eastern flight to National Airport,
just down the Potomac from the memorial to Thomas Jefferson. The four were jet-lagged out and sick of airliner seats when they arrived. They took an airport limousine to a local hotel to sleep off their travel shock. The young businessmen checked out the next morning and were met by a car. Chapter 14. Second Chances.
There ought to be a law against Mondays, Ryan thought. He stared at what had to be the worst way to start any day, a broken shoelace that dangled from his left fist. Where were the spares, he asked himself. He couldn't ask Kathy. She and Sally had left the house 10 minutes before on the way to Giant Steps and Hopkins. Damn. He started rummaging through his dresser drawers. Nothing. The kitchen. He walked downstairs and across the house to the kitchen drawer that held everything that wasn't someplace else. Hidden beneath the notepads and magnets and scissors, he found a spare pair. No. One white lace for a sneaker. He was getting warmer. Several minutes of digging later, he found something close enough. He took one and left the other. After all, shoelaces broke one at a time. Next, Jack had to select a tie for the day. That was never easy, though at least he didn't have his wife around to tell him he'd picked the wrong one. He was wearing a gray suit and picked a dark blue tie with red stripes. Ryan was still wearing white button-down shirts made mostly of cotton. Old habits die hard. The suit jacket slid on neatly. It was one of the suits Kathy had bought in England. It was painful to admit that her taste in clothing was far better than his. That London tailor wasn't too bad, either. He smiled at himself in the mirror. You handsome devil, before heading downstairs. His briefcase was waiting on the foyer table, full of the draft quizzes he'd be giving today. Ryan took his overcoat from the closet, checked to see his keys were in the right pocket, got the briefcase, and went out the door. Oops! He unlocked the door and set the burglar alarm before going back outside. Sergeant Major Breckinridge walked down the double line of Marines, and his long practiced eyes didn't miss a thing. One private had lint on his blue high-necked blouse. Another's shoes needed a little more work, and two needed haircuts. You could barely see their scalps under the quarter-inch hair. All in all, there wasn't much to be displeased with. Every one would have passed a normal inspection, but this wasn't a normal post, and normal rules didn't apply. Breckinridge was not a screamer. He'd gotten past that. His remonstrations were more fatherly now. They carried the force of a command from God, nevertheless. He finished the inspection and dismissed the guard detail. Several marched off to their gateposts. Others rode in pickups to the more remote posts to relieve the current watchstanders at 8 o'clock exactly. Each Marine wore his dress blues and a white pistol belt. Their pistols were kept at the posts. They were unloaded, in keeping with the peaceful nature of their duty, but full clips of 45 ACP cartridges were always nearby, in keeping with the nature of the Marines.
Did I really look forward to this?
It took all of Ryan's energy just to think that question of himself. But he didn't have any further excuses. In London, his injuries had prevented him from doing it. The same had been true of the first few weeks at home. Then he'd spent the early mornings traveling to CIA. That had been his last excuse. None were left. Rickover Hall, he told himself. I'll stop when I get to Rickover Hall. He had to stop soon. Breathing the cold air off the river was like inhaling knives. His nose and mouth were like sandpaper, and his heart threatened to burst from his chest. Jack hadn't jogged in months, and he was paying the price for his sloth. Rickover Hall seemed 1,000 miles away, though he knew it was only a few hundred more yards. As recently as the previous October, he'd been able to make 3 circuits of the grounds and come away with nothing more than a good sweat. Now he was only at the halfway mark of his first lap, and death seemed amazingly attractive. His legs were already rubbery with fatigue. His stride was off. Ryan was weaving slightly, a sure sign of a runner who was beyond his limit.
Another 100 yards. About 15 seconds more, he told himself.
all the time he'd spent on his back, all the time sitting down, all the cigarettes he'd sneaked at CIA were punishing him now. The runs he'd had to do at Quantico had been nothing like this.
You were a lot younger then,
Ryan's mind pointed out gleefully. He turned his head left and saw that he was lined up